Hey everyone, Brian Biela here with the Storage View podcast, and today we've got an exciting conversation, or what should be exciting, with Fungible. And Fungible is really interesting because they're taking the notion of all of these resources that get tied up in the data center and trying to find a way to disaggregate them and roll them into individual balls for applications and do all sorts of other stuff. So rather than me explain what I think they're doing, why don't we bring in Brian Biklowski from Fungible. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Brian. Nice to meet you.
So I gave the briefest and roughest of introductions of Fungible. Why don't you take over and give it to us from your perspective?
Okay, so we started five-ish years ago with a very bold vision to transform the data center and to bring hyperscale infrastructure to the masses and to give customers the ability to take advantage of everything they like about the cloud and the hyperscalers, the agility that they offer, the what can be compelling economics, but be able to do it in their own data center and, you know, achieve financial benefits that way as well as technology benefits that way. And our co-founders, one is Pradeep Sindhu, and Pradeep, well known in the industry as a co-founder of Juniper as well. And the other is Bertrand Serlet. And Bertrand was a direct report to Steve Jobs at Apple for quite some time, working on the operating systems there. And what they noticed is that Moore's Law is somewhat plateauing, and that the increasing demands on the data-centric parts of workloads, so the networking and storage level, the customer needs are increasing at a far more rapid rate than Moore's Law is able to keep up with, and there's an increasing dichotomy between what customers want and what general purpose CPUs are capable of delivering. A similar dynamic to what happened with sort of the floating point, highly computational world and the advent of GPUs. And we saw an opportunity to significantly transform customer infrastructures by building the Fungible DPU, or data processing unit, specifically for those data centric workloads. And we've developed the chip as well as several commercial solutions that are instantiations on top of the chip.
Okay. Well, it's interesting because you're talking about the chip, which is important, and we'll get into that. But large IT vendors have been talking about this concept of better leveraging your assets for since the beginning of time. I mean, you've been at EMC and NetApp and Pure and other places, and you've probably told or heard told a similar story before. We've seen demos, you know, from Dell years ago about, hey, wouldn't it be neat if you could take the unused stuff from over here and mix it with the CPUs that are over here and then have a thing that's higher utilized? But in terms of broad adoption outside of HPC or certain government agencies or whatever, I mean, there's no one's really had success with this. And I'm just wondering if it's because it's complicated, never really worked well, or if it required something like the chip that you're talking about to be able to really leverage these things the right way.
Well, sometimes what are really great ideas need physics to catch up with them and the available okay. technologies to catch up with them. You know, somebody may have had the idea of an electric car that could go hundreds of millions of dollars on a charge 100 years ago, but if batteries just physically didn't have those capabilities then, you know, that doesn't mean that there'll never be an electric car. It was just the idea was a little before the time.
Too early.
Okay. Realized. But what we have realized is, to your point, what you can do with traditional components is somewhat limited. And if we could have brought all the benefits that we're bringing, like for, like we were chatting beforehand, one of places I worked previously was SolidFire, and where a very similar storage, the storage instantiation of the DPU is fairly similar architecturally. It's node-based, it's network-attached, it's network-based data protection. But each fungible node is 30 times more performant than a SolidFire node. And SolidFire has some really great, and NetApp has some really great software engineers. And we didn't get a 30x improvement just because of our software. We got a 30x improvement because it's paired with silicon that's custom designed, custom built for what we're asking it to do. And to me, one of the really exciting things about the storage product is the validation it provides to the opportunities available to the with the fungible DPU. So what we've proved, the storage cluster delivers great performance, a great feature set we can get into later, but it also validates that in this case, function specific silicon delivers performance well in well ahead of what general purpose silicon can deliver for data centric workloads.
Well, so how do you think about that relative to the DPU? Because a storage array in itself, I mean, the limitations are kind of everywhere from an architectural standpoint, right? And one of them is the CPU, right? Because the arrays never have latest gen CPUs. So they're normally some 6 or 8 or 12 core, way down bin, and normally, what, 2 generations old from whatever Intel shipping at the time. Now AMD is involved, but we're not really seeing adoption there at the stored traditional active storage node kind of thing. They've gotten better on networking, so we're seeing at least 10, 25, sometimes 50 or 100, depending on, or 64, 32, if you're looking at fiber, depending on the array. But on the other side, if you take a high-end server node with dual proc latest whatever, and then put software on top, we still don't see all the performance available either, because even though you have the highest end hardware, there are processing inefficiencies, software inefficiencies, driver issues between components. So while the storage array tends to be much more hardened, much more reliable and predictable, the higher end server doesn't necessarily rocket those numbers all the way through the roof. And so what it sounds like you're saying is that because of the way you have both your application, your software side, and the dedicated silicon, that now that combination is right to get the performance out of all these individual components that both of the scenarios that I described are unable to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you look at the storage industry and, like you point out, where what traditional storage products are capable of. So if you think of a storage array as a CPU surrounded by a network, it could be a fiber channel network, could be an IP network, and also surrounded by, and we'll talk about very high performance SSDs. Mm-hmm. And storage systems haven't been able to drive the network to full capability, and they haven't generally been able to provide the full capability of all the SSDs behind them unless they make a very specific decision to go very storage light on their architecture because they want to be able to actually realize the drive speeds. And the challenge there is that what's between the network and the drives doesn't have the capability to feed either side of it at full speed. So with us, it's the silicon, but it's also having written software specific to that silicon. So for example, like we run our compression algorithms on chip, and with software that was written specifically for the DPU. So we run compression at line speeds. And there's not this sort of, do I want to save disk space or do I want to lose some performance? Now, in a world of 10 years ago or 20 years ago, maybe you didn't need the full capability of all of the spindles available to you or full performance, and you didn't need the full capability of the network available to you. So it was okay that you had, you know, 80 gigabytes a second worth of spindles, but you're only pushing 10 out of it. But if you think of modern workloads, you know, AI workloads, ML workloads, mm-hmm. deep learning workloads, you know, the choke point is feeding data in and getting data out. And the traditional architectures, you know, become a choke point in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we see that in the server scenario, we can saturate two 8380s with a couple SSDs doing some intensive database workloads, and that's not even mm-hmm. that hard. So now if we can do that with four or five SSDs, you've got 20 more sitting in that server that you may not be able to do a whole lot with if you're hammering the CPU that hard. But on the storage array side too, I mean, similar sorts of problems under duress, you start to see the breakdowns in either CPU, maybe a little bit in DRAM, but definitely networking as well. But so take a step back and talk about your DPU for a minute, because obviously we're seeing those come to fruition in a number of different ways now, right? They're showing up on NICs, that NVIDIA Mellanox are making, Xilinx is doing smart NICs too. We're seeing it show up in SSDs, in computational storage, from the Xilinx and Samsung deal, or NGD, or ScaleFlux. There's so many ways these types of products are being used. I think we're starting to get to a point where it might be confusing to understand what a DPU is. Why isn't this just a fancy new FPGA or ASIC or whatever? And then where you apply it in terms of your strategy on how to leverage this new way of computing. So yeah, I know you're not a systems engineer, but at a high level, how do you guys think about this or communicate it to customers to help clarify what exactly this DPU concept is in your nomenclature and how best to apply it to your overall infrastructure?
Yeah, I think we're beyond the point where it's getting confusing, and we're at the point it is confusing. And it's been an evolution for us as well. And you know, one of the conclusions that we've come to, which shouldn't have taken us that long to come to, but it did, is in the end, customers care a lot more about what it does than how it does it. And so what we are, you know, increasingly focused on is discussing the attributes of the benefits we provide. And then one, like, we have the world's fastest scale out block storage system with up to 15 million IOPS per node in a seamless scale out architecture with robust quality of service. The ability to run file workloads on top of it. So there's a lot of really, and we can point to customer pain points. Like if you have, lots of bare metal workloads that you shouldn't have to make that trade-off between the inefficiency of locally attached storage and the availability issues with locally attached storage versus the performance you really want to get. So our messaging started with basically, unfortunately, the way I started this conversation, which we have a DPU and here's what our DPU does. And we've tried to evolve it into here's what we can do for you. And when customers question the how can we do that, like if I say, you know, I'm 30 times more performant per node than what you're using today, you know, there's good reason for a customer to say, I don't believe a small company can do that. And then we can explain.
Well, sure. I was going to ask that next. I mean, 30x is a big number. And we saw those claims, and you know those claims from your prior companies, when the new hybrid and all flash guys were coming into the scene, like Pure, like, you know, some of the other guys, Tejile and whoever else at the time, they were hammering the incumbents, including Dell and EMC and HP, on performance and usability. Those are like the two things, right? We're more performant because we're using flash, we're more cost effective, and we're prettier. So three things, right?
Yep.
And even back then, there might have been an argument around data reduction when other guys were only on hard drives. But 30x is a big number. So talk talk to me about how you get there.
Because we have an engine specifically built to do what it is we want done within data-centric workloads, and others haven't. So it's not like our people who write compression algorithms are 30 times smarter than the people at our competitors who write compression algorithms. You know, we spent 5 years building an engine that would run it better. And we can take advantage of that. And, you know, having a programmable processor that we've already built a security stack, a networking stack, storage stack, and knowing what it's capable of for data-centric workloads, you know, opens up a whole window of possibilities regarding not only where we can take it in the future, but where our customers will be able to take it. Because we couldn't build a storage system if you couldn't program the processor. And, you know, we're increasingly giving customers more flexibility to program that processor themselves. So it's a combination of, here's the initial commercial instantiations from us, our storage system, our fungible data center, and our PCIe cards with a DPU on it. But, you know, we're at the beginning of a long journey, and having this underpinning that others don't, just, you know, lets us, the potential of where we can take it is much broader than I think anyone else has the opportunity.
Well, so it's interesting. You hit on something there just in passing, but I want to hit that one more time. So your chip is programmable, and you said that even customers can tune that with a little education, I hope.
Yep.
So for those that have a really good understanding of their workloads, can tune it further for their specific use case.
Yep, absolutely. And when we look at, being able to help customers with deep learning workloads, machine learning workloads, you know, one of the ways we'll be able to do that is by embedding some of the logic that those workloads depend on into the silicon. And, you know, if you think of my 30x performance advantage, you know, some amount of that is I can continue to just make 30x more performance available for the core storage functions, or I can let customers use some subset of that to do, you know, optimize other parts of their data-centric workloads that are important to them.
So let's go backwards now a little bit, because we kind of jumped into this DPU notion and these either chips or cards that are within your storage product. But go one more step back, because the whole stack, the whole fungible stack includes top of rack switching, compute nodes, composer nodes. Kind of walk us through from that entire infrastructure standpoint, how you guys think about the individual components and how you're piecing those together.
We have the fungible data center, what we call the fungible data center, and it is basically a bare metal cloud in a box. So it includes from top of rack switches to industry standard servers with our PCIe cards in them, as well as the fungible storage cluster. So if you are the application owner, if you're the responsible for the AI environment, at either potentially, you could be a service provider wanting to offer it as a service, or you could be running it for your own organization. Instead of having to figure out this brave new world yourself, you know, we deliver it turnkey. And in from the time it is powered up, plugged in, it's on the network, you know, you can be deploying your workloads in under 5 minutes. And you can offer your customers a marketplace of workloads, like, you know, here's a certain server type called Brian that, you know, we deploy often. And anytime a customer wants an instance of Brian, they will request it. They will request it. It will assign the amount of cores, the amount of storage, the other attributes of that function. And when you're done with it, you can disaggregate it. So, but for companies out there that they're trying to sell composability, you know, it's really, really hard to build a new market, especially if you're a younger company. But so our approach to that is we take the risk out, we deliver it top to bottom, we support it top to bottom. The other approach we have is the commercial instantiations of the DPU, like the storage cluster, where you can deploy the storage cluster, which in and of itself is a composable disaggregated architecture. It just happens to be all storage nodes. And you can then build upon that towards, you know, more that future vision of hyper disaggregation and hyper composability across your whole data center environment.
So it seems to me then you're a better fit for more dynamic environments that have a lot of applications that spin up and down. I mean, 30x on the performance side is one thing, but with the speed of a lot of flash and technology these days, there may be some customers that are just humming along in a traditional environment, and they're fine with the performance they're getting, and so moving for performance reasons may not be highly motivating. But in other cases where you're perpetually setting up and tearing down applications, that flexibility that you offer is pretty interesting. What bring some more reality to that? What types of environments, or what are your customers doing specifically where that flexibility comes through?
Okay, well, there's two pieces to it. So why don't we start with the fungible data center, which is where we deliver the networking, the storage, the CPU cores. So in that case, you are spot on that the value is more fully realized as the customer environment is more dynamic. So if I let you compose, you know, logically compose machines on the fly and logically decompose them on the fly, but your environment changes once every 5 years, that's not going to be useful to you, because you're going to set it up once and never need to change it.
You'd be done with it, right?
But if you are a large multi-tenant environment, if you have a huge, you know, a number of developers, you know, spinning up test environments and needing to spin them down, traditionally in those cases, a lot of companies buy a test environment every time another development group wants to do test. And then when it's done, it sits dormant or almost dormant until another group needs a test environment. And instead of remembering that last one's there, you go and you buy another one. And that's why, you know, utilization in enterprise data centers in aggregate tends to be 30% or less. So what we allow, if you think of traditionally how you would configure a server, you know, you think of, you know, what does this workload need? And based on what it needs, I'm going to pick a number of cores, a speed of cores, how much memory. If you're putting storage in it, you'll pick an amount of storage. You know, instead of doing that server by server by server, you now do that for your whole data center. And you say, in aggregate, I'm going to need 2,000 cores, 3 petabytes of storage, X amount of bandwidth. And you can, logically stitch that and unstitch it together however you like. So for the data center, the top to bottom with the composability, that dynamism really matters. On the storage cluster front, it's more about the performance requirements and the need for future growth. Because with a true scale-out architecture like ours, like anytime you add a node, you get another 15 million IOPS, which is really nice. You also get more bandwidth. You get more capacity. The data re-spreads itself out, so every node in your cluster is nicely balanced and evenly allocated. So if you think of the capabilities you get with that scale out system, one of the advantages is you don't need to buy anything before you really need it, because as long as you give us a couple weeks notice to get you a node, as soon as we plug that node in, immediately the performance is available to you, the capacity is available to you, the data restripes itself out just like that node had been in the cluster forever. And there's a lot of efficiencies for customers, because it's really hard and increasingly hard for customers to figure out what their requirements are going to be 3 or 5 years from now. So if you think of a traditional scale-up architecture, like this is a little overly simplified, but most customers or companies offer small, medium, or large. Mm-hmm. And if you're a client, you say, I know I need a medium. I really think I need a medium, but if I'm wrong, it's really expensive and onerous and time consuming to turn it into a large later. So I'll go buy a large just in case I need it. Mm-hmm. And X, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, you're making that same decision again, where with an architecture like ours, once the data is there, you're never migrating it. You can always make any data set more performant by just adding more nodes into the cluster. And then with the quality of service capabilities, you can assign whatever level of performance you want to any of those volumes.
Well, it's very, especially at the fungible data center level, it's very cloud-like, right? When you go to Amazon or Google or whatever, and create your machines. I mean, you're picking cores, you're picking instance types, you're making those decisions, you're picking amount of storage, and so that's not dissimilar with what you're doing here. It's just on-prem and within your control. Thinking about application types though, in highly dynamic organizations, what's the fungible story when it comes to containers? And then I'm going to kind of shrink back a little bit when I say this one, virtualization.
Okay. I'll start with containers. So we are the design point for the fungible data center was a bare metal cloud with the assumption that there would likely be containers running on it, and the integrations are there and really nicely done. From a virtualization end, we don't see it as much playing in that space, because we feel what customers would be building with the data center are probably, like I mentioned earlier, more bare metal like environments, and that are running more of their greenfield workloads, which
emerging applications, as they would say, right?
Yeah, which generally aren't as virtualized. Okay. Now we do actually have on our store within the DPU, we do have a light hypervisor that's actually within the DPU.
Okay, interesting. So let me ask you another architectural question. As you go through and you talk about this, one of the things that keeps jumping into my head is the guys at DSSD, they were trying to solve a problem of getting flash more closer to the CPUs of the hosts or client servers. And one of the ways they were doing that was there were a bunch of fancy PCIe bridging, but ultimately it required a DSSD NIC or HBA in every single machine and every single host. And they really stumbled on that hardware requirement. not because of any sort of compatibility problem with any of the servers. You could use any server with it. But ultimately, customers didn't really care for that implementation type. Now, I know your setup is different, but you still require these dedicated hardware components. How are you bridging that issue with your customers? Is there less of concern these days? Or I'm just wondering if that's a hang up at all and how you're accommodating that.
I can't speak to the DSSD analogy just because I don't know enough about DSSD. From a portfolio perspective, the storage cluster requires nothing that goes into the client machines. So no custom soft, no, they don't have to layer on any other software or install any other hardware to take advantage of what the storage cluster offers. So there, it is just a non-issue. When we get to the fungible data center, it coexists. So the network layer that provides the composability sits on top of TCP. So it coexists with existing customer networks. So they don't, it's not an all or nothing as far as when you deploy it, but certain attributes of the fungible data center won't be as valuable if you don't have our cards in those servers. So the customers can decide where to put them and where not to put them. But again, with the data center, it tends to be more greenfield environments where it's less of an issue. And with the storage cluster, it tends to be more brownfield environments. And in those cases, again, the customers don't have to, you know, we just look, we're just a block store.
So two distinct, you know, products, the complete data center, which is in the box and ready to go, and you can add as you want. The storage is separate. What about the DPU itself? Is that something that you'll license, you are licensing, or would we see that come into products from other companies, other vendors? Tell me about that.
We don't generally offer it to most of the market, but we do offer it for potential very high volume purchasers. So think hyperscalers, potentially traditional IT manufacturers that would want to be able to deliver some of the advantages we've been able to prove the DPU is capable of with our storage cluster. Maybe they'd want to enable some of those in their own products, where we'd be talking, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of DPUs a year. For the vast majority of the market, it's the fungible data center or the fungible storage cluster.
So in a little bit of a technical glitch during our recording yesterday, you'll notice different drinks and shirts on myself and our participant. Brian had a power outage when he was in the middle of my question. I don't think he was trying to dodge the question because he came back today to finish the podcast. So we're going to pick up where we left off, but if there's any sort of bumps in the feed or audio, or I forgot what I asked yesterday and I asked him the question a second time, that's why it's a little bit disjointed. But Brian, glad to have you back. It looks like you have power again.
Yes, and on behalf of New York State Electricity and Gas, I apologize for the issue yesterday.
Well, no problem. What I was asking you as your power dropped was really around, you know, how do you guys think about the products and where you expect to see traction? Because you've got the whole stack in the fungible data center, you've got the 1600 storage node, and of course the DPU itself. But I'm curious about the storage node specifically. It seems like that's the easier in for a POC or a startup opportunity for you guys to sell into. Do you expect that to be the bulk of your business versus the data center, the full data center stack?
We're still learning exactly what the breakdown will be. But to your point, the storage cluster is absolutely the easier in. So for me as a go-to-marketing salesperson, it's always easier to sell into an existing budget category. So with our storage cluster, there's an established budget category, there's an established decision process, there are established decision makers, and there's a compelling value prop compared to traditional offerings. And you just need to find those buyers that what's compelling about you is meaningful to them. So they tend to be easier to qualify, shorter sales cycles, and that'll be the higher volume of our transactions. So you'd mentioned the DPUs, and for very high volume consumers, so think hyperscalers, or think even traditional infrastructure product providers that want to be able to provide the benefits we provide across our offerings, potentially embedded in their offerings, either in their clouds or in the products they are taking to market. So those will not be a high quantity of opportunities, but they will be very, very, very large opportunities. And there are several of those in play. And the data center, that's kind of a new market. And the good news part is the messaging is extremely resonant in that customers know that they want to be in a world like that. It's just a matter of when they want to be there. And another thing that can be challenging with it from a go-to-market end is it hits every part of the stack. So if you're dealing with a customer where the people that make networking decisions are different than the people who make storage decisions, then it's a more complicated, longer sales cycle. And one of the things to me that's really exciting about Fungible's model, like we talked about yesterday, is you can start with tactical solutions and grow into a fully composable, hyper-disaggregated environment, or you can start at your endpoint and lay out your workloads and applications from there.
Okay. So as you think about sticking with the storage product, as you think about where you'll find that success in getting that into market, especially in the enterprise, I mean, you guys are kind of shipping your own thing at the moment, or are you also using third-party servers? How does that work from the box standpoint?
Other than the DPU, the components in the box are all standard. So they're standard SSDs, memory standard. They are custom designed chassis for us. And one of the interesting things about our chassis is if you crack the cover on them, they are totally DPU powered. Every piece of functionality we provide, a customer knows is DPU powered, DPU accelerated, and comes with all those advantages. So it's not like there's a hidden general purpose CPU in there that's, doing encryption.
That's interesting. Okay, so if we pulled apart a typical storage array controller, there would be generally an Intel CPU in there, there'd be four sticks of RAM, there'd be lots of other components in there times two, right? For an active controller. So you've got no main CPU, no Intel CPU in there at all?
Nope.
Oh, okay. It's
fully DPU powered.
Way of thinking, right?
Yeah, and it takes a little longer to come to market that way because you can't, the bad news is it takes longer to get things done because you got to do it yourself. The good news is every time you deliver something, it's better.
So it's closer to a JBOD with your DPUs in it rather than a typical compute node.
Yep.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. And a lot of the traditional storage products, from a hardware end, they kind of look like servers with a bunch of storage slots. Mm-hmm. So that's not us.
So how do you then take advantage of new technologies like PCIe Gen 4 or something like that where that's reliant on the host chipset? If we're removing that from your equation, then how do you get to new technology like that? You've got to program it yourself.
Depending what the technology is, we either need initiators, drivers, some level of way to interoperate with it. But for things like drives, which are, you know, primarily what we need to keep up with, mm-hmm. You know, there aren't any issues in integrating those really, really quickly. And, you know, you'll see over the coming months, incremental announcements from us in that regard.
Okay. Are there redundancy concerns that customers have? Anytime you do something different, it just requires a pivot in the way customers think about how they consume these things. Do you have customers that worry about the high availability, or maybe I need twice as many DPUs in the system because I'm worried about one failing? Like, how do they think about that?
Yeah, I'd say most every customer's high availability concerned. So it's a discussion topic in almost every sales cycle. The architecture is there from a hardware perspective, so there aren't single points of failure or anything like that. What gets really interesting with us, because we use erasure coding, so we are an EBS-like data protection mechanism, and we control data placement really well across nodes, that we by default provide rack resiliency because of our adaptation of EBS that is, you know, really hard, if not impossible, for a traditional storage architecture that's using like controller-based RAID or something like that to accomplish. So if you had a 10-node cluster, you could have each node in a separate rack, and you could then lose if you lost multiple racks for whatever reason.
Sure.
You know, up to a certain failure domain that you would select, you wouldn't have any concerns about data availability.
Okay, so you talked about upcoming announcements around new technology support, maybe new drives or capacities or something. I won't force you into NDA territory and get in trouble with the corporate overlords. Relatively new product, where do you have to continue to enhance? I mean, these things, typically it's like data services where there's the next step is, you know, snapshotting, data protection, you know, other features and enhancements, additional support for networking protocols. What are you guys focused on for the next, you know, quarter or two that's not super secret about what you feel like you need to add to the product?
I think there's two phases companies go through in that, and that we are going through. First is you have to get your differentiation nailed. Mm-hmm. So for us, it is performance. It's the way we do data protection. It's the resiliency of our scale-out distributed architecture. And, you know, that needs to be something you know you can hang your hat on forever. And then there ends up being, you know, a whole set of kind of cover charge features. Like an example might be, you know, we require real-time replication to a second data center for our entire data set. And no matter how much they love everything about us, until we have that feature,
yeah, it's a no-go.
You know, then it's a no-go. Like we have a, by the time this drops, a version of the code coming out that will have snapshots where we haven't had snapshots before. So there's been some amount of pent-up customer demand waiting for snapshots, and mm-hmm. then that. So, you know, we know what the list is of sort of traditional features and which which ones are important to our customers, and we'll tick them off one by one. And what I tell our teams is, if we go in, like, we have a really interesting story. So if we go in and we tell it well, assuming it's somebody that cares about our market space and understands what we do, it doesn't necessarily mean you'll sell it there, but you will get them really interested and excited. And there may be, they may not have a project at this point. They may not have budget at this point. They may require snapshots and you don't have it yet. But if we go in and do a great job telling our story, that door will always be open to us. And we're going to add increasingly layer on those other features. And each time we do, our addressable market expands.
Yep. Yeah. You start spreading those ripples out, and now you can hit more of those use cases, mm-hmm. which makes sense. Well, this is really interesting for customer or prospective customers or for people that want to go play with this or see it. What resources do you have available short of a full POC to explore the capabilities further? Or what's the sales cycle looking like? What are you walking customers through demos live? I mean, what are the options there to learn more?
Yeah, we tend to have an introductory meeting that goes half an hour to an hour. If it looks like there's a fit between, you know, their needs and our offerings, then it'll be an hour to 2 hour deeper dive. If it then makes sense for testing, the easiest way to do it is we have a very robust POC environment that I believe you've seen and are used. And that's a great way to do functionality testing to verify our performance claims. If after that, there's reasons there needs to be an on-site POC. Maybe there's data sets you need to test that can't leave your premise or something like that. Sure. That's also an available option.
And to be fair, we have done, probably about an hour and a half in terms of going through with your technical team and getting the walkthrough on how it works. The UI is intuitive. I mean, it's pretty straightforward for what it is. Sometimes those things can be a little bumpy early on, but your team's got it pretty tight. I was just going to say, we might just have to keep pushing your team a little bit to get a couple of these bad boys in here. Yeah. I know Kevin's itching to put those to work.
Yeah, and I think one of the things customers really want to see in the environment is that the parts they care about from a differentiation end are there, mm-hmm. and that other than that, it looks exactly like what they're used to. So it's not going to require a massive new management framework or overhead or 1,000 pages of new run books that, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to get the performance, they're going to get the availability, they're going to get the agility, and it's just going to slide in. It's from a storage cluster end, it's going to slide into their environment and be none or near no management overhead for them going forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're excited. I'm not sure if you caught it, but Chris Meller and I did a podcast a number of weeks ago, and he called out you guys as one of his really interesting companies to watch. We were talking a little bit about Composable then and some of the others in the space then. Kind of back where we started, where a lot of people have tried this and haven't had tremendous success. But your approach is, it's nuanced, but it's entirely different in terms of the hardware underlying it and your sort of fundamental view on what you're trying to do. So, we're optimistic onlookers, I suppose. Yeah. And like I said, we'll keep banging on your team to get something in here so we can do a deeper dive on the performance and the technicals. But, until then, we certainly appreciate you joining us on the podcast, putting a little more information out there about what Fungible's up to. And any parting words, Brian? I'll give you the last shot.
Thank you for giving me day two.
Yeah, that was a first.
Problem. It makes me think, we need an electricity grid that's as resilient as our storage cluster, at least around where I live. So, like we talked about prior to getting on, I really enjoyed the conversation. And, thank you for having a lot of depth to it.
All right. Thank you, Brian. And guys, thanks for tuning into the podcast, whether you're on the audio stream on your favorite podcast player or checking us out on YouTube. We appreciate your support. Thanks.